Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in the warm welcome from Detroit Economic Club welcoming Dave Ricks.
Thank you, Verinder and Steve, for that introduction. It's a pleasure to be here in Detroit. My grandparents on my maternal side were Detroit natives, actually first generation immigrants to America, really a demonstration of the American dream. And they've passed now, but I'm left wondering whether they would be more proud that one of their offspring could come and stand at this podium, or more surprised that I would be that one. They always thought I was wasting my time, actually. But they, here I am, and I'm proud to be here presenting to you. I know this is like a Saturday Night Live skit. It's difficult, huh? Maybe if we do this. How about that?
There we go.
Okay. Purdue Engineering there. So every president since the 1970s has spoken to this group, and I know just recently the ambassador from Israel, along with CNN's Mike Rogers, were here discussing Middle East peace and global security and other weighty topics. Very important and probably a little more exciting than healthcare. But I'm here to talk to you about healthcare. Instead of the present, I'd like to talk to you, though, about the future. And the future of healthcare to me is a woman like Marie Schiller. Marie has type 1 diabetes. She's had it for 35 years. She does everything a patient should do. She eats right, she exercises every day, and she religiously takes her medications. Yet during only three periods in her life did she have her type 1 diabetes under control. Two times were when she was pregnant with her two children. She received extra attention, extra checkups, ultrasounds, non-stress checks, and other tests to make sure that her and her unborn children were in good shape. Fortunately, they were, and they're healthy today, and she controlled her diabetes well. But this was enormously expensive care. The third time has actually been in this past year. Marie started seeing a new endocrinologist, and he asked if she would allow her to share her continuous glucose monitoring data with his organization's electronic medical record system. He also asked her to communicate about those results with him by text, and she agreed to this. Now, if her doctor sees Marie's blood sugar out of range, he sends her a text to see what's wrong or to adjust the insulin dose. If it's an especially good day, he sends her a text telling her to keep it up. Marie visits a doctor every 6 months now, compared with every 6 weeks before. Marie is healthier, and she spends less time and money on health care. Digital technology and pharmaceutical technology are now offering solutions like this that can move most chronic care from centralized hospitals, surgery centers, and clinics into patients' homes. Healthcare could stop being a high-cost destination to which people come, like a shopping mall, and instead become a low-cost delivery system, more like Amazon. This shift from a destination system to a delivery system can also solve many of the cost problems we've struggled with in U.S. healthcare for so many years. In my comments today, I'd like to discuss how technology can bring low-cost healthcare to millions of people like Marie, but only if we redesign our healthcare system, both how it functions and how it's financed. The U.S. healthcare system today was designed actually 50 years ago for the issues of that day, to treat mostly acute episodes of illness and to do it inside bricks and mortar facilities with lots of people and very little technology. But I think we can all agree those aren't our main objectives anymore. Today, our primary challenges are to help people like Maria live independently with illness over a long period of time, chronic disease. Yet we continue to pursue that task with the same high-cost, high-touch tools that were built in a different era for a different job. We know the results of this mismatch, an unsustainable rate of cost growth, as you can see in this next chart. In fact, 30 years from now, one disease, Alzheimer's, alone will generate more spending in Medicare and Medicaid than the entire U.S. military budget. Our current path threatens our economic competitiveness as a nation. It also threatens our economic stability. It's true that spending on prescription drugs has also grown and is a significant part of this system. It's higher in the U.S. than other developed countries. But to remind you, everything in the U.S. healthcare system is more expensive. Labor, facilities, administrative costs, devices, and yes, medicines. Prescription drugs account for only $1 out of $7 in the U.S. healthcare system, about 15%. That proportion really hasn't changed since the 1960s. It's similar to most European countries and actually lower than in Canada and in France. We think prescription drugs should be part of a cost solution. Medicines are one of the only deflationary parts of our healthcare system. After an invention occurs and a patent life expires, generics to brand name drugs bring down prices sharply, and innovators like Lilly go on to invent new things. Despite these facts, though, we are concerned about the affordability of medicines today and the affordability challenges that many patients face. To many people in high deductible plans, they pay too much out of pocket, sometimes several times more than what their insurance company pays. We at Lilly and our peers in the pharmaceutical industry are trying to address these challenges in the short term through innovative programs that reduce patient out-of-pocket costs. But in the long term, we are eager to get rid of a system of massive price discrimination, where the biggest actors, mostly middlemen in our healthcare system, get the best deals, and individuals pay the most. This current administration recently released a blueprint to reduce drug costs. The blueprint is a mix of good and bad ideas from an innovator's perspective, but it is driving a needed conversation about wholesale reform of one important part of the healthcare system, the drug delivery system, so that access can improve and affordability can be there for everyone. That's our goal. I think that's everyone's goal. So how do we reach this goal? The answer to rising healthcare costs is the same as it's been in every other industry, from my perspective: to unleash technology to bring down cost and expand access. In healthcare, we think it's time for something like the PC revolution. Many of you may remember Apple's famous ad in 1984, which aired during the Super Bowl, which correctly predicted that personal computers would free people from expensive and inaccessible computing technology built around mainframes. I personally saw that prediction coming true firsthand as my first job was at IBM. A computer chip that contained 2,000 transistors cost $1,000 in 1970. But when I arrived at IBM in 1990, that price had fallen to 97 cents. And today, that same chip cost about 2 cents. Because computing has become so cheap, because volume has been driven so high, it's become ubiquitous. PC makers put a new computer on every desk, in every home, in every school, essentially. In healthcare technology, especially pharmaceutical technology, we've been able to demonstrate cost reductions when we improve access and drive use. One example from the early 90s is the HIV/AIDS epidemic. This was a looming cost and humanitarian crisis. But the introduction of antiretroviral drug therapy led to a 70% reduction in death in just a few years, saving millions of lives and millions in hospital costs. In fact, a recent analysis by the Columbia Business School found that the introduction of all new drugs in developed countries saved $2.50 for every $1 of spending on new medications. Today, we have the opportunity to ramp up cost savings even more with rapid advances in digital technology, such as telehealth, remote monitoring, and artificial intelligence. One example I became aware of is when an Australian health system offered remote care coordination services to people with type 2 diabetes. They collected home monitoring information. Those patients then saw a drop in their blood glucose of a full percentage point when managed remotely versus seeing a traditional doctor. That's a large enough effect size to get a new drug approved at the FDA. The cost of care also dropped, about $900 per patient per year. This is what the power of technology can do in healthcare. Yet, technology by itself isn't enough. In other industries, technology has only been transformative when it has operated in an efficient, networked way. And here in Detroit, I can think of no better example than the story of the automobile to prove this point. Henry Ford used technology, the moving assembly line, to reduce the time needed to produce a single Model T from about 12 hours to 90 minutes, which allowed a two-thirds reduction in cost and pricing. But the automobile didn't transform American life overnight, and it didn't reduce transportation costs until the building of a national highway system several decades later. Only after that, as you can see in this chart, did the U.S. see large-scale, society-wide cost savings. Technology needs organization, not just technology for technology's sake. In healthcare, some people think the best route to savings is simply to cut the costs of this technology, or perhaps to ask the doctors and hospitals to charge less for their services. But it seems to me rationing the benefits of technology and reducing the incentives to create more of it are steps in the wrong direction. Most people I know want better health outcomes. They don't want to settle for less. The real problem is that we have a healthcare system that resembles the road network of the 1920s. We haven't created a highway system for healthcare technology to drive on, so we don't get the transformative improvement and cost reductions that we could. It's like we're driving a Corvette on a dirt road. So here's how our healthcare system slows the impact of this technology. First, it's deeply fragmented. Care is delivered mostly locally in hospitals and clinics, many of which doctors and nurses are not the employees of those systems. And often they serve a small geography. Patient information still resides predominantly in these local providers' records. Even though they are now mostly digitized, the information still can't be shared easily. It's siloed. No wonder it takes 17 years on average for a new practice or new medicine to become standard of care in the U.S. healthcare system. 17 years. Second, the constant growth and demand for labor-intensive, facility-based services crowds out and leaves little money for new medical technology to be adopted, even if that technology has a long-term payoff. And finally, and most importantly, our system really has no ability to discern value. Products or services, including new ones, are priced, and the whole system's reimbursement is built on cost recovery and cost shifting. Cost shifting means the exact same service or product is priced at vastly different levels depending on who is paying and on where the care is delivered. The end result is that the system is focused on recouping costs rather than delivering value. This variation exists all over the healthcare system, much of it driven by government rules. Every healthcare organization is charging some prices that are profitable and some that are not. That includes my company. Insulin, Lilly's largest product, is a great example of this. Medicaid, including here in Michigan, pays the lowest price for insulin in the world, about 10 cents per vial. And I can assure you that's far below our cost to produce it. But patients in high-deductible health plans, or those paying cash, actually pay the highest prices in the world, around $300 per vial, a 3,000% difference. Because they're blocked from receiving rebates that Lilly pays to middlemen and people in the healthcare system to reduce costs. And their payments are actually subsidizing the Medicaid system. So at healthcare's high end, cash-paying patients and commercial health plans are charged inflated prices. Since these households and businesses, both large and small, have tight budgets, These inflated prices force them to ration the very technology that can reduce their own long-term costs. On the other hand, prices at the low end of the market are artificially depressed by government rules. So these payers and providers aren't very interested in adopting cost-saving measures, like new medicines and consumer-powered technology. For example, telehealth may be cheaper than a physician's office visit, but it's not meaningfully cheaper than what Medicare and Medicaid pay for a physician's office visit. So these systems, Medicaid in particular, mostly stick to the old service network they know, rather than adopt new technology that could actually bring down system costs. More than a decade after we have iPhones and Skype, which made video chatting an everyday experience, there's still spotty reimbursement and scant use of something like telehealth. Instead of innovations aimed at large populations and our big system problems, we end up with something else. We see innovations aimed at specialty conditions, specialist physicians, and niche health conditions. In each of the past 5 years, the FDA has approved more new specialized drugs than it has primary care drugs, as one point of evidence. In this world, to recoup R&D costs, drug and device manufacturers are charging higher and higher prices to fewer and fewer patients in order to recoup the cost of going to market. And in prescription drugs, cost shifting is especially visible. Insured patients pay nearly 20% of their prescription drug bills in their out-of-pocket expense. Compare that to just 5% of hospital costs. Many hospitals even use medicines to generate profit. One study found the average cost of markup in a hospital for a medication is 250%. Pharma companies like ours negotiate with payers to reduce patient out-of-pocket costs, offering billions in rebates each year. But even before these rebates reach health plans, the pharmaceutical supply chain has skimmed off about 20 to 30%. 2 out of 3 employers share not one penny of those rebates with the workers or the ill patients who need the medications, as you can see here. And many Medicaid programs, including the one here in Michigan, use none of their rebates to fund Medicaid or even any health initiative. Rather, these funds go back into general state priorities. So long as our system uses technology as a revenue generator at patients' expense, we will never realize the cost savings that technology has brought to other industries. If we want to unleash the power of technology in a way that both improves health and brings down cost, we need a better system. Of course, any reforms must appropriately balance innovation and cost, and we shouldn't try to change our system overnight. But I would argue we can move quite a bit faster than we are today. Just last week, our company received approval for a new medication that's called Olumiant for rheumatoid arthritis, a serious condition. We're trying something a bit different. We launched this drug at a 60% discount to the competitors in its field. And those competitors, most of which were launched 20 years ago. This is a kind of experiment to test out a low price, low rebate, less cost shifting type of model. And if there's any of my colleagues who are in the insurance world or pharmacy benefit managers or employers listening today, I hope you embrace this new way of operating and reward a manufacturer willing to try a lower list price strategy. If we're going to build the efficient network that can unleash the power of today's technology, we all need to work together. And I argue today we need to work together on 3 key goals that can enable this system. First, to digitize our system and really unleash the power of data so it flows as freely as electricity does through the electrical grid. Second is to empower consumers. Every consumer should be empowered with the information and benefit designs that help them manage both their health and their healthcare costs. And finally, we need a payment system for healthcare products and services that is based purely on the value they produce, not the costs they are recouping. So let me touch on each of these for a minute. Digital technology is a prerequisite to the other parts of the ideal health system I'm laying out. It also by itself can reduce costs. We know from consumer world, an online retailer can reach people worldwide with about a $10,000 website, compared to a few hundred thousand dollars for a bricks and mortar store that can only reach one small community. Digital technology speeds up change and improvement because we can monitor and track data. Think how quickly we can change our offerings online versus in a physical environment. Digital technology can also unleash transparency, generating new data on what works and what doesn't. One example of this is the adoption recently in many cities of digital technology to manage traffic flow. This allows transportation departments to schedule green lights to the right lengths each time of the day, improving traffic flow and reducing the need for new or wider roads. Now, some worry about access with digital technology, but a recent FCC report this year showed that 98% of Americans have access to either high-speed, terrestrial, or mobile internet. Digital technology can reduce costs because we already have an information superhighway on which to move. But to bring this to healthcare, we need some rules for the road in healthcare. First, we need a nationwide standard for sharing medical data. It's short-sighted for digital health companies to each use their own standards. Every new technology goes through this period of non-standardization, but it's also true at some point we need to come together, standardize how information is shared. I think this is proven in other sectors to be the means by which we unlock true value. It happened in the railroads, it happened with automobiles on roads, it happened with the internet more broadly. It needs to happen in digital health too. The federal government can play a key role here. Imagine if they tied one standard to all Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement. I bet we'd see conformity pretty quickly. Second, we need to solve privacy challenges. Patients must control their own data as it enters and exits the healthcare system. But I think also there's a benefit to sharing data. When patients agree to use the healthcare system, we think there should be some agreement to share their data for the good of everyone, so we can learn what works and what doesn't. Again, here, the federal government can play a key role as the navigator of this system. Second is empowerment. In nearly every industry I'm aware of, consumers have been the catalyst for reduced cost and improving quality. But that hasn't happened yet in healthcare. Why? One key reason is it's virtually impossible to get meaningful cost and quality information before you receive care. So we need massive transformation in transparency. When many people talk about transparency in healthcare, they think about disclosing the money in every transaction. And Lilly has recently increased our transparency disclosures voluntarily, and we're considering more. But few of these after-the-fact disclosures, which describe each link in the chain, are meaningful to patients or allow them to make better choices. Transformative transparency means giving consumers meaningful price and quality information up front, in a form that they can use to make rational buying decisions. For example, when you buy a GM car, you don't care what they paid for each and every of the 30,000 parts in it. You care what the price is when you're going to drive it off the lot. We don't have that in healthcare. Think about how upfront transparency on costs and quality delivered digitally and has brought down costs in many other industries, like air travel, car rentals, and many others. We can do this in healthcare. Whatever system we adopt, any price cuts that do happen must be shared with patients. Starting this year, in our own health plan, we have 70,000 employees and their family members in our own health plan, we began passing through all rebates for drug discounts to our employees. United Healthcare, the nation's largest health insurance company, and Aetna, one of the largest, have recently announced they'll do this for their customers next year. The Trump administration has recently considered a plan to do the same in Medicare Part D. We think these are all steps in the right direction. Also, more employers should exclude chronic medications from their high deductible plans. We do this. In high deductible plans, your cost resets every January 1st. But if you have a chronic disease, your disease doesn't reset. We need to make sure that patients can stay on their medications for the long term. But many employers haven't done this. And one of the reasons is the IRS hasn't made it clear that this is a deductible tax expense, like a preventative service, the standard required to exclude from their taxes. This administration or Congress should clarify this immediately. Upfront coverage of chronic medicines is an immediate step we can take to improve adherence and improve outcomes. Finally, value. Healthcare can no longer be about delivering certain products or services. The future must be about making people healthier through whatever product or service does that best. Our company has signed many value-based agreements for medicines. Most of these contracts compare our medication to other alternative therapies or treatments based on the actual experience in a population in an insurer's market. The way they work is if a patient taking our medication does better, the price doesn't change. If their medication does worse, we lower the price to compensate. We are standing behind the value of our products, and I think everyone in the healthcare system should be doing the same. Some drug companies have taken this actually even farther, offering full money-back guarantees in the case where you have a non-response in cancer, for instance. All healthcare products and services should be held to these same high standards of evidence. I was alarmed at a recent study in The Lancet last year, which showed that a very common shoulder surgery, orthopedic surgery, that's been performed for decades and is very expensive, actually reduced pain and outcomes less than a placebo or dummy surgery. That kind of randomized placebo-controlled study is rare in the surgical world, yet it's the standard for medical products, pharmaceuticals, and devices. I think it should be the standard across all of healthcare. And this will then help us understand what works and what doesn't and what things are worth. We also think prices should be more uniform. They should vary primarily based on outcomes for patients, not on convoluted behind-the-scenes negotiations from big actors. So how do we make all this happen? Throughout the healthcare system, we should embrace risk-sharing contracts, like the value-based agreements I described. Ramped up at critical mass, this can transform patient outcomes and costs in our system. The greatest progress here has actually occurred in Medicare Advantage. This is a special program the government offers where providers and insurance companies receive per-person payments up front, or capitated costs, and then allow them to care for high-risk patients and benefit if they do better than the standard system. Patients are signing up for Medicare Advantage at faster rates than traditional Medicare, and they strongly prefer the high quality results that are being delivered. Now we need to accelerate that kind of transformation across the entirety of the healthcare system. We need changes to the rules the government uses on our highway. In pharmaceuticals specifically, we need help from the government to reduce the constraints of the anti-kickback statute, which interfere with our ability to conduct value-based pricing. Medicaid and the private health insurers they hire should also be more encouraged to experiment with innovative funding types, like stretching payments out over time or value-based agreements, as I've just described. Employers also can play a key role in implementing these types of changes. That's why the partnership announced between Amazon, JP Morgan, and Berkshire Hathaway on healthcare benefits, to me, is exciting. If these three large companies can use their scale and technology to create real change and move to value-based payments, it could help nudge the system forward. A change I hope is also coming is the integration of spending, that between pharmaceutical benefits and medical services, rather than managing them in silos. So the recent mergers of Cigna and Express Scripts and CVS and Aetna, or announced mergers, I should say, do present an opportunity to break down that silo and compare the benefits of technology directly to medical service. If on a large scale, employers and payers demand value, I'm sure our industry will find a way to deliver. So let's all work to create this future together. I think we can all agree patients are hungry for it. Patients like Marie Schiller. Marie is getting value-based care because her doctor is part of risk-based contracts that reward him financially when he keeps her blood sugar under control. Marie is empowered because her insurance plan offered upfront coverage for her continuous glucose monitor. Marie is experiencing the power of digital technology because her doctor knows ubiquitous connectivity allows him to care for her every day, not just during infrequent office visits. Marie is now actually working for this better future. She joined our company 3 years ago, and she leads a research group to use digital technology to help patients manage their chronic conditions, to adhere to medications, and communicate directly with their doctors. We call this vision connected care. This is care that comes to consumers rather than making them come to it. This is care that is digitized, that empowers consumers, and it is built on value. This is what we will give. We'll give our healthcare system what we want it to, one that is a healthcare system that is affordable and accessible for everyone. This is the disruption that patients are waiting for. Let's work together to make that happen.
Thank you, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, let your applause show our appreciation for a lucid and great informative lecture.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have a number of questions submitted, and some by students. So let me start with one that has really taken a national debate almost everywhere in print and television, and that is, what do you have any suggestion on what could be done about the national opiate crisis?
Yeah, thank you. I think that is a critical health question and one we're deeply interested in. You know, just some statistics first. It's reported that we experience about 120 deaths per day due to opioid addiction and overdose. That is almost the equivalent of an airline hitting the ground every day, and we haven't had one of those in a long time. Believe me, if we were crashing an airplane every day, we'd be doing something radically different about it. So this calls for significant change in what we're doing. There are a number of common sense steps that have been put in motion already that I think make good sense. There's been new money put into treatment for addiction services. That's essential. Some of the Byzantine rules of Medicaid and Medicare prevent appropriate care and duration of care for what is a lifelong illness of addiction. There have been new guidelines from CDC, which Pharma and Lilly endorsed, to limit opioid prescribing to 7 days or less. Percent of patients who have an inpatient surgery in the U.S., 99% are discharged on an opioid, and one out of 15 of those becomes addicted. So we have to reduce exposure and reduce use. Take-back programs are an important part. We do know that opioids that are unused get recycled and often used by addicts. We've got to take them out of the system. Maybe from my position, the most important thing we can do is invent pain medications that are non-addictive. I think ultimately that's what our industry has contributed. We have a robust effort in that area. Pain management is one of our core five therapeutic areas. We have several late stage projects now, including one which will wrap up next year. Hopefully we'll submit to the FDA and launch in late 19 or early 20, which will be indicated, hopefully, for osteoarthritis pain and chronic low back pain, the two most common uses of opioids. And perhaps this will present an alternative to physicians and patients that can allow them to skip the opioid step, which is causing all this harm to begin with.
Thank you very much. Another question is, I think you mentioned indirectly a number of areas that, what is your opinion about the outcome-based contracts between the drug manufacturer and payers? The question emanates from the fact many patients go from one doctor to another, one hospital to another, and then end up with really getting no relief of pain or the disease. Should there be a contract between drug manufacturer or healthcare industry with the payers or the patients that I'm willing to pay for what you're asking me, but there should be an outcome that is desirable?
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned in my talk, we're aggressively pursuing what we call value-based or outcomes-based agreements. The idea here is that the price changes based on value, not on quantity of utilization. In the world we're in now, based on quantity, what the buyer's incentive is to reduce the quantity so their cost goes down. But in the case of a medication, often that's required to get the good outcome. So we have a conflict inherent in the financial incentives in the system today. By moving to a value-based or outcome-based system, we put all of ourselves on the same side of the table and with the patient, which is, let's get patients on the right medication, let's have good adherence, let's get improvement in health status. When that happens, the idea with these is people get paid. When it doesn't, we don't get paid. And I think that's a much better system for the future. Where we've implemented this, and as I said, we've implemented dozens of these, we found great success. And, you know, I come from a proprietary point of view, being a pharmaceutical executive, but actually medicines work when used appropriately. They work really well, and probably better than most every other thing. So we are betting on this, not just because it's the right system, but I think our business will thrive in an outcomes-based world. We want to be a leader in that.
Thank you. This next question is one that will be addressed very vigorously in this year's election in November. What is the Affordable Care Act impact on your business and how it has related with Trump's reforms that impacted?
Yeah, complicated topic, controversial one, obviously. Our industry supported the Affordable Care Act when it was introduced in March of 2010. For one reason, and that was because the promise was to expand access. I think what we've learned is that access does not equal affordability. To do this, a lot of rules were embedded in these plans, which drove up the cost of these programs. The cost of these programs, as I outlined today, is too high. And to manage that, states and insurance companies on the exchange plans cost shifted a lot of money to individuals. So I think a lot of people are confused who bought ACA plans because they thought they were going to get affordable coverage, and what they got was coverage that is less affordable. They're paying for insurance, but a lot of the money still comes out of their pocket. I think we need to learn from this and seek to improve. I've outlined today some of the ways to do that. There is another part to this debate, which I have a personal strong position on, which is, should we have a more consolidated and common system across the company, or across the country, or should we have a more localized system, one where experimentation and customization can occur employer by employer and individual by individual? We strongly favor choice in this debate. That's not uniformly true, but that's our company's position because through our experience, single payer systems like we've seen in other markets, and I've operated the company in those markets, leave a different list of dissatisfactions than our system does today.
Thank you. In this, men and women who live and work in this area have seen a lot of mega mergers between hospital, healthcare facilities. Some worked out, some did not, and some are continually approaching it. What is your opinion about what impact this mergers will have on a patient who's caught in the middle?
Yeah, great question. These mergers are happening because the system I described, the 50-year-old system, which is really tied to the passage of the Great Society measures by Johnson, which built and funded all these hospital systems in a real way, I think it's the signs of fragility, that hospitals are merging and combining to reduce costs, but they're doing it without changing the care delivery model. What I'm arguing for is a fundamental change in the care delivery model. And I think what probably people miss when I speak to healthcare executives is that consumer expectations have moved dramatically about service delivery in every other part of their lives, but they really haven't moved very much in healthcare. And I think it's time for us to adapt.
Thank you. Now, this question comes from students. I think it's very interesting because many of them are hoping to be in the field. And that is, what advice would you give to students that have an interest in pursuing a career in pharmaceutical industry?
I'd say that's a great idea. You know, I joined my company for a number of reasons, but one of them was the purpose. You can spend your life working in a lot of noble businesses, but I can think of a few callings that are as purposeful as turning science into products that help sick people. And that's what we do. We try to remind ourselves of that every single day. And because that's an awesome responsibility, we often take a lot of criticism. I understand that. Some of it well-placed, I think, and some of it not. We're working to improve how the system works around us and how we work within it to make sure we can fulfill that mission as best we can, help more people, and speed up science so that more cures and advancements in therapy can be there. It's a rewarding industry because it is complex and offers great careers. So any of the students here who, when they're done with their degrees, want to apply to Eli Lilly, I strongly encourage them.
Thank you. Dave, are you ready for lightning round now?
I don't know. It sounds frightening. Fire away.
This is a new initiative, and I love it. This set of questions and short answers. Something on your bucket list?
Climb Kilimanjaro.
Okay. Person you would like to have lunch with?
I'd like to have lunch, well, there's a lot, but with the current Pope would be top of my list.
Outstanding, thank you. One of your favorite songs?
Oh, my favorite song is Led Zeppelin, Fools in the Rain.
Oh, another one, great. Favorite team to growing up?
San Francisco Giants.
Outstanding. Your best sport?
That I'm best at?
your best sport? Your best at, or the one you like best?
I like cycling. I may be best at that.
Thank you. Good for health. One of your favorite movies?
The original Star Wars.
You got a lot of takers on that one. Your go-to website?
Google.
One way you disconnect?
Where do I disconnect?
Yes.
In the woods. I like the outdoors.
A favorite vacation spot?
Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
Now you can find him there, right?
Yeah. These are combined answers. Yeah.
Describe, if you could, Detroit in one word.
The Tigers.
Beautiful, yes. And this will need some time. Advice to your 25-year-old self.
Slow down, and be more patient.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, what a treat. Dave Ricks.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Wow, ladies and gentlemen, once again, Dave Ricks. Dave, thank you for traveling from Indy to be with us today and for your important thoughts on healthcare disruption. Dr. Modgill, outstanding job as presiding officer. And one more time for Klabe and Penny, our scholarship winners, a great round of applause for them. And like we like to do at every DEC meeting, on time every time, 1:30, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming. This meeting is adjourned.